Time for our weekly update. Malcolm Honlein is with us, Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. We call this the weekly update on Friday mornings here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Yeah, great to be with you, Nachum, as always.
May I first wish you mazal tov on your brand new granddaughter, Gabriella Bach, and it is both, of course, your family and the Bach family that I go way back with, so that makes it always extra special. So mazal tov on that.
On her engagement, thank you very much. Oh.
what did I say, her birth? That's hilarious. That is hilarious. So mazal tov on the engagement to the Kala. Your life goes by quickly, folks. We're up to the engagement now. The Kala and the Chassan from all of us here at JM in the AM. Also, for those of you who haven't been following the news quickly, the office, closely rather, what has happened to me today? If you haven't been, too many late nights, Malcolm would say. If you haven't been listening to the news closely, you may have not noticed that a list has been published by the Office of the President of the State of Israel. Awardees of the Presidential Medal of Honor coming up in January of 2025. And among them, our very own Malcolm Honlein. I say mazal tov to you, Mr. Honlein.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I'm very flattered by the decision that they made. It's a formal process, and God willing, look forward to being in Israel to receive it. And I receive it on behalf of all the listeners to JM and AM, and you are partners amongst all the others. And I want to give mazel tov to my daughter, Mira Adest and Jerry Adest, and to the Kala, Gabriella Bach, the daughter of Sender Bach, Olam Shalom, and to Zacharia Leibowitz, the son of Rabbi Mrs. Arya Leibowitz, on their engagement. And I celebrated her birth, but it's a little late. And,
I told you, always timely
to acknowledge, you know. But
life goes by quickly. Look at that.
This is amazing.
Yeah, the span of moments, she became a full-fledged adult. Yeah, and I appreciate that mention, by the way, about partnership. Our listeners, maybe you even met me to a degree, because I'll never forget, and I'm sure you remember this, on the night of the Conference of Presidents Gala, which was, I don't know, how many years ago? Was it 10 years ago or so? Maybe even more. And you did bestow on me, and I do consider it up until this date a great honor that I actually introduced via the Voice of God apparatus a million heads of state that were there, and so many different ambassadors and representatives who were in the room. And that was really cool, and I'll never thank you enough for allowing me to do that. But at the end of the evening, you actually called me on stage, and that made me feel that I had a small slice of the entire process of the work being done on behalf of the Jewish community, especially here in the United States, but the world. So I want to thank you for that all these years later. How do you like that?
Oh, it's the first time. Thank you. And when you joined me on stage, you were a big slice of the part, right? But it was, but of course, I do appreciate it. And this is the association of so many years. People still stop me, who remember from the radio every Friday morning driving into work, and now can listen 24/6.
Yeah, whenever they want.
Whenever they want to. And you think, we hope, that how many people we informed and made a difference in the way they look at the world, understand the world, which is what we want, and to get them to talk on Shabbos with families about what has happened in the week before.
And if you think that Malcolm took a cheap shot with the big slice line, folks, I know him really well for decades. Yes, I will confirm that it was a cheap shot, but one obviously in good faith and with good humor. All right, I don't know where to start this week, frankly, because there's so much going on, but I guess so many people are curious about your initial reaction to some of the people that are going to be in the next Trump administration. I mean, I have a whole list here, and obviously we could go through everybody, but let's at least choose the four that always seems to catch the attention of those concerned about Israel and foreign policy in general. And I'll just ask you for a general comment. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Ambassador to the United Nations Elise Stefanik, Ambassador to Israel Governor Huckabee, and I guess we could put Mr. Witkoff in there as well as Middle East envoy. Any initial impressions, reaction, analysis once you've heard this portion of President Trump's list?
So first, you got to look at it in context because, you know, every president has his own style or her own style, and the roles can be very independent, and they give them a lot of autonomy, or they centralize the decision making in the White House, and the president does what he wants or tries to supersede, in fact, in some cases, the roles of the members of his cabinet. Now, I know presidents who have disregarded some of the members of his cabinet, hardly talk to them. Wow. I would see them more often than the cabinet members. And so each president has his own style. I think President Trump certainly has his own style. But you have to say that this is the A-list for us in many respects. It's an all-star team when you start with Stefanik, who really made her name taking on the presidents of the universities. And I think at the UN, to have somebody with her stamina and her courage and outspokenness is really critical. And she's going to face many tests. And I think her pro-Israel positions and some have been well proven. Marco Rubio certainly has demonstrated his bona fides towards the Jewish community in Israel and other issues. Then you have Lee Zeldin being there, even though it's EPA, Governor Burgum, who's announced as Secretary of the Interior, the Secretary of Homeland Security are all people that the Council for Secure America have worked with, which is the coalition we built between the oil and gas industry and the Jewish community and pro-Israel. There are, if you go down the list, the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary although he comes from the media, has been very outspokenly pro-Israel and very strong positions in Israel. Governor Huckabee, needless to say, he visited Israel many times every year, and it was a voice of the evangelical community, but far beyond that, and very forthright defender. We can go literally down the list of name by name of the people. And there are people who have raised questions about Tulsi Gabbard because she supported a BDS or opposed an anti-BDS legislation. And obviously Gates' appointment has raised a lot of questions, and we don't know whether the Senate will approve or he does a recess appointment. But overall, when you look at this, of the people that he's chosen to date, they are a remarkable group. Matt Waltz, also the congressman who is going to be the head of the National Security Council, has been very outspokenly pro-Israel. I'm sure we're missing some, but that lineup is really quite remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, the core of it were the ones we mentioned at the top, And you not only feel that that's an all-star team, but the majority of the remaining ones, it sounds like you're pretty positive about as well. Now, the election was 10 days ago. So subsequent to the election, president who's now a president-elect, you know, could choose to stay a little bit more in the background or could really hit the ground running, and we see what Donald Trump has chosen to do. With that in mind, there is I saw this on social media. I'm assuming it's based on a real news story. You certainly will know. He made a statement, supposedly, or was quoted as saying, that on the first day he will lift all restrictions in terms of necessary arms for Israel. So number one, is it a reliable story that President Trump actually said this at some point in the last few days? And what's your reaction to it?
So, first of all, he has said many things that he would do the first day, including being a dictator for one day and taking back a lot of the changes that President Biden made to the things that he had imposed. But I think, first, you're raising a very important point about how fast they have moved out of the gate. If you remember the last time, they didn't make appointments till sometimes a year into the office. I mean, some of the appointments and some never, because you know, there are about 5,000 jobs that have to be filled when somebody becomes president. And you remember this includes attorneys, U.S. attorneys, and it can be many other positions that don't make headlines but are very important. And the, you know, he didn't really have a Republican Party behind him. And now you see that he organized. He had people who are really doing this seriously. And I think Howard Lutnick deserves credit, others, for doing this in a really organized and serious fashion. That it's interesting that, you know, before he had a Secretary of Defense, he announced ambassador to Israel. Right. No ambassador to Moscow or London, but that, and also the appointment of Steve Witkoff to be the ambassador, to the special envoy or ambassador for the Abraham Accords and for the Middle East, and several other posts. So the fact that he was able to put in place so quickly a team, and clearly being done in a thoughtful and organized way, being able to have people from his last administration that he can draw on, because the number two positions, which don't get the headlines, are often more important, because the secretaries, they're busy running things. The real guts and policy and stuff often comes from the second and third level tier. Of course, you know, you can't replace all the people who are government workers, although you can cut back in the appointment of most head that committee together with Vivian to cut back the number of government employees. And I'm sure there are a lot of people who are very concerned about their future. So it's a very different beginning than the last time. And I think a much more mature administration in terms of being able to have the full cabinet in place weeks before they actually take office.
And is this in the spirit of what I just said, that the report is that he's ready to, and it may have been a quote, frankly, from the campaign, that he will lift all restrictions. Is there really a vote coming to the Senate floor sponsored by Bernie Sanders to block U.S. arms to Israel?
So first, on the first thing, yes, he did say it. And are there restrictions? The answer is yes, there are weapons that Israel did not get and doesn't get. On the other hand, we acknowledge the amount of equipment that is being sent. Right. Israel is using a tremendous amount, and much of the ammunition and things, where there's a global shortage, is going to Ukraine. The United States prepositioned $1 billion worth of equipment in the Negev, and there are various places around the world where equipment is prepositioned, but they need a place where it'll be secure. Many countries, of course, it will be stolen. They know that in Israel, both the climatic conditions there is good for, it's dry, and therefore the storage place is good. But most of all, that it will be available for American troops in the region. You don't have to wait till they ship it in from the United States. And second, Israel would be able to withdraw down some of it and pay for it if in a time of emergency. All of that equipment was sent to Ukraine. So, and it was not replenished, nor was it in Korea or other places. So that's one. There is a global shortage. But look, the THAAD missiles, the aircraft carriers being there were a great deterrent, very critical. The B-52 bombers sent there, the additional troops, the placement of the F-15s in Jordan. We have to acknowledge it, and Shahkar Sato for that. At the same time, we know that there is a shortage of certain bombs and things that they would need. And it sends a message, certainly to Iran, if they think Israel doesn't have the capacity. They've already been shown they were wrong on that assumption.
Right.
But I think that he may well lift the restrictions. He does say he doesn't want to be involved in wars. He wants the war over. Dermer was here, as you know, Minister Dermer, talking about the Lebanese arrangement, which I think is very feasible to see in the coming weeks.
What about the Bernie piece to this? Is there really going to be a Senate vote on this?
That's a very serious issue that gets very little attention. It's not going to happen in the Senate. It's not going to pass it, but it is a very devious move on his part that would really sanction Israel, cut off arms. And I'm sure that with some of the people in the Senate, that he would get 10, 12, maybe more votes towards it. There's a big anti-war sentiment increasing, certainly on the Democratic side. I don't believe he'll get a single Republican vote. And
leave it to him to bring this to the Senate floor, huh?
Well, he's not alone, and I'm sure in the House, AOC and others would like to. And the whole idea of the promotion now of AOC is so manufactured, it's so false, it's unbelievable. Yeah. And also, you know, Thune becoming head of the majority leader of the Senate, I think will help facilitate certainly the bills on anti-Semitism that are being held up. If hopefully it will be enacted now, but if not, when the Republicans' majority takes over, and other pieces of legislation that are being held up that are important.
Go ahead. No, we'll go back to, we're going to get back to Trump and all of this in a minute, but there's a breaking story from about a half hour ago that we saw that an Israeli airstrike in late October destroyed a covert nuclear weapons research facility in Parchin, Iran, according to U.S. and Israeli officials. So first of all, I mean, what do you know about this? And obviously this is so significant because, and on top of that, this week, it was reported that Iran has a new attitude, and it could be a Trump-related effect. They're now stepping back from their plan to attack Israel. So what do you know about the actual destruction of part of a nuclear facility there? And what can you tell us about Iran's most recent position, which again could be Trump-related, that they're stepping back from attacking Israel?
Okay, so first let's just take the attack. You know, people said to me, well, what did they strike? Why, you know, what, there was no spectacular result. The answer is that there was this, and I alluded to it on the show, that they hit facilities that were much more significant, research facilities, others that they did not take out the nuclear weapons. They took out the place where they developed the nuclear weapons, and which is more important in many respects. And they hit the anti-aircraft and the intelligence sources, you know, that able to monitor an attack. So they really crippled and stripped them of a key defensive capability. When you don't have the radar, it's like taking away the radar. And this is much more advanced in many respects. The S-300s that Russia had supplied were destroyed. So the answer is yes, it is true, I think. And the significance, what Israel did that day, set the Iranians back a lot more than people realized. Wow. The election of Trump has had consequences. Look what Qatar did in getting rid of the Hamas leadership finally. The gestures by others. But on the other hand, there are people hedging their bets. The Saudis meeting, the head of the armed forces of Saudi Arabia met with the head of the forces in Iran, and they talk about doing some joint exercise. I think everybody is hedging right now and looking at the circumstances and seeing what they roll. But most of all, for Iran, there was a meeting reported between Mr. Most and the Iranian ambassador to talk about how he can reduce tensions or what they can do. We know what they can do to reduce the tensions with Iran. It's very clear. And hopefully this administration will not succumb to the wiles and the tremendous negotiating abilities that the Iranians have demonstrated over several thousand years, and we'll stand up to it. But the message that you know, that there will be a new administration with different attitudes certainly has to shake things up. It does in regard to Ukraine, where there are other messages being sent. And in the Middle East, they look also at the appointments. It's not just us. And when they see that lineup, I think many of them have to say, and you saw that Morocco issued a statement, the first in months, reaffirming its relationship with Israel.
Right. Yeah.
So it's, you got to look at the pattern, a much broader basis, to see the impact.
A lot of high expectations out there. I don't know if they're going to be met. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored digital radio. Around the world, the web at NahumSiegel.com and the Nahum Siegel Network, and of course, the beloved NSN app. Monday starts our end-of-year fundraiser. Details about that coming up Monday morning, with a big thank you to everybody out there and the thousands that support us on a regular basis, monthly and annually. Much appreciated. More details coming up on Monday. Malcolm Honlein with us, of course. Weekly update. All right, so back to what President Trump might or may not try to do in the interim, in this period of time before January the 20th. Do you think, I mean, I asked you this last week, but maybe 7 days later, things are a bit clearer. Will he take an active role, and whether he travels to the Middle East or not, and try to secure a deal for the release of the hostages? Because there are many who think that he's the, I don't want to say, God forbid, last hope, but he is, you know, one of the key hopes to the hostages actually being released by the enemy.
So I know that in the discussions between President Biden and President Trump this week, when they met at the White House, they did raise the issue of what could be done on the hostages and what they could do together. Both the outgoing president has said that this is a priority for him and that he would work on it. And President Trump as well, both have met with families by President Biden often, and President-elect Trump has also met with them frequently. And I think there's a strong commitment to it, but you're not going to resolve it, I think, out of the context of the larger situation. Believe me, nobody wanted a deal more than Netanyahu wanted it, or the people of Israel wanted it. And you're dealing with people who have who do not value human life and only see this as extortion, and that these are fodder for them, just as their own people are. And and certainly the manipulator of all of this, Iran, that has executed about 160 people in the last 2 months, including, unfortunately, Arvin, the young Jewish man, but arresting and killing young women and kids 16 and above. And so you got to look at who has the ability to release them. I would have thought that with Israel's successes in recent weeks in Gaza, that maybe they would have uncovered more of the hostages, and maybe they know more. You know, they have to be careful because, you know, we know the price that when you're fighting in such close quarters, they put up human shields to be sacrificed, their own people, certainly the hostages. But I do believe that a deal is possible. I'm praying for it before the administration takes hold. I think a deal in Lebanon, as I said, it is very feasible. The Hezbollah is talking in different terms, but it really have to be very strict terms where they move beyond the Litani River and do not repopulate. I suggest people look at the maps, the aerial maps of what has happened both in southern Lebanon and in Gaza along the border, how vast areas have been cleared and will remain clear, that's the only protection to assure that you don't have another October 7th, God forbid. We pray and hope that we will see the release of the hostages, that we will get a deal, that with the Hamas leadership being vulnerable, if they're thrown out of Qatar, that they are not protected. They could go to Turkey. Turkey has hosted the Hamas leadership before, and Erdogan's increasing craziness and extremism, very troubling in the region. So he might be willing to host them, but I think, you know, with the new administration, they're going to be very reluctant, knowing the price they may pay. What we have to work with, make sure that the enticement for a quick deal with Iran is not the solution. We've got to make sure that it's a solid deal that stops not only the nuclear program and the raid that you mentioned earlier. Its missile production facilities were hit very hard. That we have to have a permanent change, and that can be defined in many ways.
Yeah. You know what makes a lot of people nervous? We do see that President Trump, I mean, he has said this openly, is very anxious to get a peace deal in the Ukraine-Russia situation, and he is also anxious to get a peace deal in the Hamas, Hezbollah, Israel situation. And sometimes the aggressive a pursuit of peace is not always to the benefit of Israel. In other words, we acknowledge the personnel he's put together, the attitude toward Israel, his relationship with the prime minister. Everyone's happy with all of that. But an aggressive push for peace is not always beneficial to Israel. And I wonder if that's something that you're concerned about, that he's going to want to really get things done so quickly. And again, usually it does not benefit Israel when that happens.
Decades ago, it was proven that peace at any price is not a viable policy. We want to see peace. I believe Israel is trying to create the conditions in which peace would be possible, both in Gaza and in Lebanon, but also the Houthis have to be stopped, the Iraqi and Syrian militias. And you see the small lines about, you know, they don't make big headlines, just small ones, about a strike in Syria or a strike near the airport here or there. Huge amounts of weapons are being destroyed and captured. The reality of this, of what Israel has done, is so vast. And I know it looks slow to people. It's like you're watching this war in slow motion for a year already. And most of all, the suffering of the people being held hostage.
Right.
But the fact is, Israel was facing something so ingrained, so many hundreds of billions of dollars probably spent by Iran and its allies on the infrastructure, on the continuing to find new massive tunnels. And they found one near the border with Syria. It took dozens and dozens of trucks with cement just to seal them. And that's how vast these structures are. So I think that there's a possibility. I think that the conditions are more than right. The people of Lebanon want it. Certainly the people in Gaza seem to want it. But we have to make sure that they can't come back to power, that the UNIFIL arrangement and the deal at 1701, which was arrived at after the Lebanese War, the Second Lebanese War, was totally ineffective. They did nothing. And that the longer-term prospect will be that there will not be another war, and that they want stability. Israel wants the area to be stable, too. They gave them all a possibility when they drew through from Gaza,
yeah,
and they blew it.
So true. By the way, there are, because it had been a while since we spoke, and of course the election, there is a list of stuff that some of our listeners are demanding you address. One of them is this whole movement by North Korea to help supply troops to Russia. So what do you think practically and politically of that move?
Well, I do think it's significant, not because of North Korean troops. I think, well, all the troops, when you send 10,000 troops, when Russia is very short of manpower and has lost many, many, and I don't know if we'll ever know the true numbers of how many Russian soldiers were sacrificed or were killed in this, as well as Ukrainian soldiers. So the presence there is a message that, look, we have a reservoir of people we can draw on beyond our own troops, that they may be kind of cannon fodder in some cases, but the fact is that they're there, they're fighting. They will get more proficient as they use the equipment. For North Korea, it's good because they become battle tested, and they, you know, will bring them back home. And, you know, certainly North Korea has been hostile, and it's moved its nuclear and missile production, ballistic missiles, et cetera. They are a real threat in Asia, and have good relations with China, bad relations with Japan and our other allies there, right, and certainly South Korea. So I think it's significant that it sends a message. I don't know that it shifts the war dramatically, because it doesn't appear to have, but 10,000 troops is a lot. Both sides need more manpower, and the numbers, and as they head into the winter, which is really vicious there, I think that you might be moving towards some sort of a freezing of positions. You see that the Ukrainian officials are already talking about certain concessions done temporarily, quote unquote, temporarily, rather than permanent real estate concessions. So everything that happens now, and when Iran supplies the drones and other missiles that Russia vitally needed, then that too makes a difference.
I got to ask you what you think of this move by Pidge to release videos of Alexander Trufanov, who's a Russian-Israeli hostage at the moment. Another video came out overnight. What do you make of that move, and does it matter, frankly?
It doesn't matter until he releases them, but it's a play to the Russians. You know, Putin has interceded. Trufanov's family members were released, and God willing, he will be also. But it's all part of the propaganda ploy and the way they play the game. And Russia should be, which has closer relations with them, should be sending much stronger messages and interceding. But we don't want to single out individuals. We want all of them out, and we want them out now.
Yeah, no question about that. Also, have you heard anything from Jewish leadership in Amsterdam? Because remember when we spoke last Friday, as big of a news story as it was, the pogrom or whatever word you want to use to refer what happened there, obviously things were very hectic. 7 days later, have you spoken to leaders there? Have you heard if things have calmed down and what the status is?
Well, yes, I do speak to people there and in other countries. You know, we've had Jew hunting incidents in other countries, including Belgium, Sweden. And this is, you know, the global intifada when they call for it. Again, I keep telling you, you got to take their word seriously. Yeah. When they tell us what they're going to do and we ignore it, then we pay a price for it. So the Jew hunting incidents have occurred in other European countries. We also have found links between the demonstrators and the actions they took in Paris, in Belgium, and in Amsterdam. There were more events in Amsterdam in the days following the riots after the Israelis were taken out. As you saw in Paris, there was a game. There were incidents at the game, but very contained. And, you know, soccer games generally invite certain expressions, physical expressions, and often violence. But in this case, the police, there were 4,000 French police out. So they really worked to try and contain it. And still there were incidents. But the general situation in Europe is something I've talked about here for 15 years, warning, and this was all inevitable, and you see it across the continent and even spreading into the United States, the global intifada. And unless the Europeans really crack down on the extremism, what we have been able to find through NCRI's work, anticipating and both the links and seeing how the leadership, the individuals who were involved in influencing what happened in Amsterdam and in other countries, and the messages, how they change it, and they exchange it, and the organization, and they pick it up. And one of the things we're organizing now is an international network of all the Jewish community security agencies, because we know anti-Semitism moves country by country. And just as we see the message in one country, we see it then in the next one and the next one. And what happens in Europe ultimately comes to the United States.
You've told us that French officials during all the episodes and the discomfort they had who lead the Jewish community had, of course, spoken to about Israel. Are you getting that feeling from Amsterdam that Israel is now at the top of their priority list?
No, absolutely not. And although there are people like Geert Wilders and others, they have responded on every level. The president canceled his trip to Baku to the COP29. The defense minister, the foreign minister, the minister of justice, the cabinet, the parliament, all of them initiated investigations. All of them have made statements working together with their Israeli counterparts. But will it change the fundamentals on this? No, until they really have a concerted action to root out, you know, what was done after World War II in Germany, the denazification. There has to be an effort to deal with the extremism and to try to rein in those communities. And if it means some of them are talking about deporting the ringleaders and some of which may be one step to help diffuse it. But it's becoming ingrained, and you have now a second and third generation of immigrants from North Africa, from other parts, and these people are being radicalized. And they, you know, the parents at least came to work or whatever, and these next generations have been enveloped by the radical imams and extremist ideologies, and especially the internet becoming a means to mobilize in invisible ways, partially invisible, and it's true in the United States as well. Yeah. And people should read the work of NCRI, what they have uncovered in terms of what happens in the public schools across the country, what's happening in universities people see more of. But we're indoctrinating a generation into hate and to anti-Israel.
Yeah, social media more accurately, but we get the point for sure. Finally, and this may sound like a rhetorical question, but believe me, it's not. When a CIA official is arrested for an intelligence leak on Israeli plans to strike Iran, so that does affirm for us that there are certain Iranian sympathizers even in the CIA, correct?
There are, and you know, you look at what happened with Rob Malley and what the people who worked for him, and the information has come out, and now there's a lawsuit that's been filed because no action has yet been taken against him, and that he was allowed to, he was the special envoy, and remember that his security clearance was removed, but he was allowed to go back to his office every day and still had access to classified documents according to the suit. And this is outrageous. And one of the people who worked with him was actually given a promotion and now taken out of that job at the Defense Department. The infiltration is clear. There are people who sympathize, which I guess you have in regard to all the controversial things. There are people on both sides, but there were people with close ties to officials in the Iranian government, and we have not seen the effort to really root it out, investigate it fully as it should have been, and hopefully will be, so that, you know, we're not having all this disinformation and misinformation that Iran has been very good at. And as you said, the social media campaigns, very, you know, deep state involvement, which we could spend several shows on alone.
Yeah. Have you told, just to wrap up, have you told Jewish leadership in this country that when they want to arrange for a rally in Washington, D.C., they should speak to people who have done it before?
Well, I think they I'm sure that there will be a lot of assessments about the event. I think the timing and, you know, the circumstances to it, it is not a sign of diminution, as some in the leftist media and Israel critics want to say. You know, it shows that the other thing was a fluke when 300,000 people showed up. No, it wasn't. We see the demonstrations around the country on October 7th. There were hundreds and hundreds of events across the country that were there. I find that the sentiment, the pro-Israel sentiment, increasing, not decreasing, especially amongst young people and many who were not involved in the past, as well as older people who were not involved. The revolution, the October 7th revolution, continues in the Jewish community. Huh. And I think people, that the numbers that we will find out in the end about how people voted and all that, many of these were reflections of the frustration of the people, the concern. But the feeling, I think, is stronger than ever.
Well said. I'm glad I asked. Malcolm, have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll speak, please God, next week.
Everybody should have a great Shabbos and only Simachot.
Amen. Malcolm Hohenlein with us. Weekly update, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations. Friday mornings here, 7:40 a.m. Eastern Time at JM in the AM.